Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
From the Society for Nautical Research, in partnership with Lloyd's Register Foundation, I'm Sam Willis, and this is the Mariner's Mirror podcast, the world's number one podcast dedicated to all of maritime history. Hello everyone, and welcome to the Mariner's Mirror podcast, and to this, the mighty start of several episodes on the maritime history of Australia. I've begun my odyssey in Fremantle, Western Australia, the location of the truly fabulous Western Australian Shipwrecks Museum. Let me say now how enormously welcoming everyone has been to help me set up a number of interviews that we will be bringing you over the coming weeks. A cornucopia of Australian maritime heritage, with episodes on the Dutch exploration of the coast, the extraordinary tale of William Dampier, a pirate scientist, explorer and rogue, and his ship the Roebuck, the wreck of which was discovered by a team from Perth, the construction of the replica Dutch vessel the Dyfken, that is the ship credited with the first sighting of the Australian mainland by a European. And we even have an interview with a professional model maker, a man who has dedicated his life to recreating the maritime world in miniature. And that is just the Western Australian episodes. There's more to come from Queensland as well. Let us begin today with the Dutch in Western Australia, the story of how and why they first sighted Australia on board the Dyfken in 1606, of how and why they proved their discoveries, and of how and why so many of their ships that followed the Dyfken were wrecked. To tell me more, I met up with Ellie Spillecom. Ellie has a background in coaching, teaching and art, and she worked in the town council of Zaanstad in Northern Holland for 25 years. It's the oldest industrial area in the world, where the turning windmill was invented at the end of 1500. The history and artistry of timber construction in both buildings and boats has been a special subject of interest for Ellie whilst living in the Netherlands for 55 years. When she moved to Australia in 2013, she became coordinator of the Dyfken 1606 Replica Foundation, a volunteer at the Shipwrecks Museum, and a curator of the Dutch Australian Foundation. As always, I trust that you enjoy listening to her as much as I enjoyed talking with her. Here is the passionate, the international, the deeply knowledgeable Ellie. Right, here we are. We're going to walk through into this gallery here and find out about the Dutch in Australia. Let's start with this map, Ellie, because it really does explain so much of what's going on. So we're looking at a map here which explains how and why the Dutch ended up in Australia. Take us through what's going on here.
Well, it's a map actually from the part of the Indian Ocean. We know that Vasco da Gama came long 100 years before the Dutch on the Indian Ocean. And the Portuguese and the Spanish were already mapping the whole area. And the Dutch knew that they went to get spices in this part, in India, Indonesia. And the Dutch became a powerful institution around 1600. And they decided first to, in South Africa, to put a refreshing station there so they could go easily into the Indian Ocean. So what happened is they came from the north. Before it was called the VOC, it was called the Company van Verre, and that means the company from afar. And they were actually the first united group who tried to get ships there. And when they came from Amsterdam and all around Africa, they went into the Indian Ocean, but mostly above Madagascar, Mauritius, Zanzibar.
So they'd go north up the coast of Africa, across to India, and then down to Asia.
Yes, they did that. So what Cornelius Houtman thought, well, the Roaring Forties wind is coming from South Africa.
Yeah.
On the 40...
Parallel.
And then it would go to somewhere on the west coast of the Big Southland, Hollandia Nova called. Because in 1606, the Duyfke was traveling around here in Indonesia along the Spice Islands in Papua New Guinea. And they went a bit too far and they bumped into a part of what's now called Queensland. It's called Weipa. And there they mapped the coast for about 300 k's. And they knew there was something bigger connected to it.
Right, so they knew there was a big land there. And so by coming across from South Africa right along the 40th parallel, and this is on their way to the Dutch East Indies, they went a bit far and found the west coast of Australia.
Yes, and that was actually 4 years after Brouwer found the Roaring Forties, and it was by the VOC a point like, okay, now ships have to go to take that route because it takes months less to go to Indonesia. Then they decided, okay.
Yeah.
And Dirk Hartog was actually one of the first with the Eendracht in 1616 to do that route from Brouwer's.
So they changed the way that they went to the Dutch to Batavia, to the East Indies in Java.
Yeah.
And it demonstrated so clearly here this chart that if you go straight across from the bottom of South Africa, you touch Australia and it blows you very powerfully, very quickly there. It's a fantastic map. It shows all of the different the trade winds, and so it makes much more sense about how difficult it is to get down from India towards. Towards what were the Dutch Spice Islands. So that's a fantastic introduction. Now let's go and have a nose around and see what we can see.
Yes, so this is one of the first paintings also from the first fleet. I mentioned the Company van Verre, that was before the VOC started in 1602. And this is in 1595 when they came back to Amsterdam. And they actually took some spices with them. So they did.
This is the first fleet to go to the Indies?
Yes.
Yeah, the first spice fleet.
Yes. And it was not really successful straight away because they couldn't find the pepper and the islands. And of course, the Portuguese were dealing with that cargo area. And so, there was a problem. But they succeeded. So that is actually the start of...
The start of the whole story, how they ended up here. Now let's go around the corner because I want to see these amazing posts and the plates linked with the early Dutch settlers here. The early Dutch visitors, not really settlers.
No.
I think it's a truly magnificent thing. So walking through the gallery here. Now, on my right is a large clear case with two timber posts in it, and they're very, very weather-beaten. Tell me about these.
Well, Dirk Hartog in 1616 came all along the west coast. He started roughly around this area, and he went up north. And what happened is that he... Halfway, he thought, I have to leave my mark.
Right.
And he thought, I have to find a place where I can go. And there's always wood on the ship and always pewter plates. So he thought pewter is a very, very soft metal. So he pushed it between two blocks of wood, and with a hammer and a nail, he wrote.
Here's the inscription. Here we are.
Yeah.
1616, the 25th October, is here arrived the ship Endracht of Amsterdam, the Uppermerchant Gillis Meebase. You're better at pronouncing that than me.
Meebase of Liege. Liege is a luik. Skipper Dirk Hartog of Amsterdam.
The 27th ditto, we set sail for Bantam, the undermerchant Jan Stins, the first mate Peter Dorks van Bill. Year 1616. So this is inscribed on a pewter plate. It's about it's a large dinner plate, I'd say. And he nailed it to a post and left it there.
It's a dinner plate, and you see the line in on the side.
Yeah.
Where you know the it was slightly elevated.
Yeah. So what we're looking at here is a replica of the original plate, because the original is in Amsterdam. Yeah.
Yes, in the Rijksmuseum.
Yeah.
And it has been here for a couple of times.
Yeah.
On special occasions, but in 2016 it was the last time the plate could travel.
Yeah.
Because it's so sensitive and so thin.
It's a wonderful thing. I'd like to have been the person that sort of came and found it. So this isn't the only plate. And also, you've got the post. I mean, this is the amazing thing. This is the post that the plate was hammered to.
Yeah.
It's a wonderful thing. It looks like a huge oar with plenty of nails hammered into it.
And the original Hartog plate, pole plate, we don't know what happened with that. Because when the Vlaming came, he found pieces of the pole, but it was 80 years later, so it was in 1697. So they decided to put a new piece of wood that actually Vlaming took from Rottnest Island, where he visited, and where were still a lot of trees, and ships had always wood to repair things.
Yeah.
So he put the post there. He found actually the plate buried from Hartog about 80 centimeters in dust and sand. So he was very lucky that he found it.
Good for him
area.
To search around.
Yeah, because there was a map with the area marked with a cross.
Yeah.
And by the descriptions of the logbook he had from Dirk Hartog, he knew that it was in Turtle Bay. That's the name of that area on Dirk Hartog Island. So he knew the place, but it took a while to find it. So then he puts the pole there, but then he thought, if I take the plate to Amsterdam to prove that the Dutch were the first, well, I have to leave something behind. And what he actually did, the same as Dirk Hartog, he took a pewter plate, a dinner plate.
Mm-hmm.
He did the same, smashed it between two plates of wood, and with a hammer and a nail, he carved in it.
And this is the plate that actually survives here. So we've been looking at the Hartog one, which is a replica, but this is the original thing. This is the Vlaming plate.
Yes, it is, from 1697. And the Vlaming thought, well, if I put that plate there, I have to acknowledge Dirk Hartog and his text, because he was the first, and then we have proof that 1616 is actually the date. So he wrote actually the same as what Hartog wrote, and then he had his own text behind it. And the name of the ships, the Geelving, the Nijptang, het Wezeltje, the date, the names of the people who were there, and that's actually what this plate is all about. So that was left on the west coast, and then the French came.
Right, let's carry on walking around, because there's some magnificent items upstairs which I'd like to talk about. And we're going to go through the Batavia Gallery. I should just say for all of you listening that we're going to do a separate episode on the remarkable history of the Batavia, which is the real centrepiece of this magnificent museum as well. But we'll give you a bit of a taster now, a bit further on. It's a wonderful old building, this.
Yes.
How old is the building?
It is from one of the earliest buildings of Fremantle. And I always forget the date. It's on the front.
So was it built by convicts? It must have been.
Yes. A lot of buildings are here, like the first jail and other things, are all built by convicts.
We're just going to walk in through the mind-blowing Batavia Gallery, so the Batavia Wreck. Just tell me a little about that and we'll come back and do a proper episode. I'm looking at a large section of the actual ship, which has been raised from the seabed, and it's suspended from one wall. It's truly magnificent. Just give us a rough idea about what about the Batavia history.
Well, the Batavia was actually the special ship named after the city Batavia, what's now called Jakarta. And it was the most important and one of the biggest ships ever built in 1628. And it was so special because it took a lot of special people to Batavia, some high-placed persons from the VOC, but also wives from people who already worked there. And it was their main voyage. So it is actually, they were in a fleet of eight, and Pelsart was the commodore of the whole fleet. And there was a person on the ship that was a person non gratia in the Netherlands, Jeromius Cornelius. And he was actually from an organization so powerful that the then government didn't know what to do with him. So they thought, if we put him on a ship, he can't do any harm. We give him a position in Indonesia. But he lost his wife and his daughter of syphilis. And we think that he had syphilis as well.
Right.
So he was not really thinking.
Not thinking straight. So the Batavia is wrecked off the coast.
Yes, because he started a sort of plot planning a mutiny.
Right.
And what happened is that when they sailed from South Africa, the refreshing station, there was a big storm and they got separated from the rest. And Pelsart, because this was the main ship, was on this ship as commodore. But the captain was more into the mutineers.
Yeah.
So they were not really careful, and what happened is they took a different route and they ended up, thought it was moonlight shimmering on in the water, but it was actually the reef.
Right.
So they smashed the reef, and 60 to 80 people were died straight away, but they managed to get on the islands. But then what happened, that Pelsart thought, okay, there's nobody going to save us. So the ship was on top of the reef for 3 days. And then they decided, okay, we can take all the gold, jewels, everything off, and a lot of other things, food and water. But then we have to find a rescue ship to get us from these islands, because there were still more than 200 people. So he left, and then Jeromius Cornelius took over again and decided, we're going to finish the mutiny, we're going to kill the people who are not working with us, and we're going to build ourselves a ship, or if the rescue ship is coming back, we can take it over, and then we have a long life rich.
Yeah. It's one of the most extraordinary horror stories in maritime history.
Yeah, and it's not typical Dutch, because, you know, mutinies were not really a Dutch thing.
Yeah.
So for us, it's really a strange history as well.
Yeah.
And there are about, I have 20 books about the history, and 10 in Dutch and 10 in English. And Russell Crowe wants to make a movie about it.
I'm not surprised, it would be a very good movie. So the wreck was found and it was raised. When did that happen?
1963. It was. They knew there were wreck things around, and especially fisher people who were around. They always thought, okay, we don't tell anybody, because otherwise the Western Australian government will say, oh yeah, you can't go there and you can't go here. So actually a lot of people already took a lot of things from the sea bottom and knew things, but they never told.
Yeah, I mean, we're standing here also looking at a skeleton of one of the victims of the mutiny.
Yes.
So a cutting wound to the head.
Yes, he has a cutting wound on the head, and we know the sword that's in another part of the museum. You see here the deep wound he had. Mm. So he must be on the island. He is found on Beacon Island as well, where the most of the... We have a lot of skeletons, and we have more in the museum.
Yeah.
But so we know this was a crew member.
This was a crew member who was struck over the head with some kind of sharp implement, sword or
with a sword.
Axe. With, definitely with a sword.
Yeah.
It says here, records show that many of the mutineer victims were driven into the sea to be murdered and their bodies left to the tide and the fishes. So... you have some skeletons, but not all of them.
No, not all. No, not all 200.
Now, the display of this hull is, or the section of the hull is completely remarkable, and it's on a bed of bricks. Tell me about these bricks.
The bricks are the ballast bricks. They are yellow bricks. They are found in the north of the Netherlands, but also in the west, made of clay and dried in the sun. And a lot of people in Indonesia really liked the bricks because after they were not used as ballast bricks anymore, because they get spices in the ships, and the ships would be good enough with the balance. So they didn't need the bricks. They left them in Indonesia. They sold them to the Dutch people there because they like to make a brick house. And not, you know, a bamboo house or a wooden one. So they were very happy. And you still can see in Jakarta and other countries, villages, a lot of bricks from these ballast bricks from all the 4,000 VOC ships. Yeah. Not all, of course, because we know how ships didn't end up in Indonesia all the time because they were shipwrecked. But the company built about 4,000 ships to view.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Now, just beyond it is a really remarkable thing. It's an enormous stone portico, which, I mean, it's a huge, magnificent entrance to what would have been a fort. And this, if I'm right, was on the Batavia. This is a replica of it, but the stones here were also on board the Batavia acting as ballast.
Yes, that's correct. They come from Germany because the Netherlands didn't have quarries with bricks like this or stone. We could make from clay something, but not this. And they were on the ship. And in the beginning, when they found the wreck, they didn't actually know, the people from the museum, what it was all about. They were numbered. So when they laid them out after they cleaned them, they thought, hey, this looks like a sort of big portico.
Yeah.
And then they found out that it was actually the portico for the city Batavia, what's now called Jakarta. Because they also found drawings where they saw a scaffold standing, waiting for the big blocks to finish the castle Batavia that was named after the city. Because the Netherlands were not the Netherlands named. We call the Seven Provinces or the Batavian Republic.
Yeah.
So Batavia comes from the Batavieren. That was a group of people who came from South Europe up the river. So Batavia was a very important name, and everything was called Batavia.
Yeah. And this portico is amazing. It's it looks like it could come from a Roman temple as well. So
yeah.
Two large columns with a classical archway in the centre and a sort of triangular piece on top. Amazing to actually have that on board a ship, and very clever to have rebuilt it in this museum. Now let's pop upstairs and find out a little bit more about the Dutch.
Yes.
So we're walking through here. So was this a warehouse?
Yes, it was a warehouse, and you can see some pieces like constructions all around here where big blocks of stuff were moved from one place to another. The door, what you saw just there with the portico, was actually where the horses came in.
Oh, I see.
So the horses came in, and they were around to get all the stuff in there.
Yeah. And we're upstairs now, and we can look down onto the inside the hull of the Batavia, which, as I say, is suspended at the appropriate angle, so you can. It's like looking inside the ship itself. Truly, truly impressive. Now, here we are. This is a gallery full of artifacts recovered from the Dutch wrecks on the west coast of Australia.
Yes.
So let's go and find out a little bit about those. Oh, actually, before we do that, let's stop and talk about this. This is the spice table.
Yes.
This is what makes the whole thing make sense. What are we looking at here?
There are different spices, of course, that they were taken out of Indonesia. And the spices were very, very expensive in those days. It took, of course, a long way to get there. In the early days, Arab people would trade them with small boats to the mainland, and then with camels and horses up to Constantinople.
Yep.
Or Venice. But we have the spices that the Dutch took, and those are the five important ones.
Okay, what are we looking at then?
It's pepper, cloves, we had nutmeg, and we have star anise and cinnamon.
Yep.
Those are the five important. Of course, the mace, that's the outside layer of the nutmeg, was very important. And we have, of course, coffee, but that was not really. It's a spice, but it's, and the Dutch took it, but it was not the main thing. But these five others, and one nutmeg was worth a horse in that time.
Wow.
So it was the same amount as gold, and the Dutch were very clever, because they driven up the price. If they knew, okay, there is a demand to nutmeg or something, they would cut off all the trees on other islands, keep it on one island, and the price went sky high.
Okay.
So
very clever.
Yeah, the Dutch were very clever in trading and keeping the price very, very lucrative
for
them.
Keeping control of it. So they then took to the ships and had to sail and get back with all of the spices. Where we're walking now to a display which demonstrates the four Dutch wrecks that have been discovered here on the west coast of Australia.
Yes, there are four wrecks discovered, but a lot of people think there are more shipwrecks. But we have the Zuid-Dorp shipwrecked about 800k up north from Perth in 1712. Then we have, of course, the one in the Batavia,
yeah.
1629, the Zeewijk, 1727, and the Gilt Dragon of the Vergulde Draak in 1656. those was the Gild Dragon was the closest to Perth. The others were the Batavia and the Zeeweg were on the Abrolhos Islands. That's about 500 k up north from Perth in the direction of Geraldton. And then the Zuidorf cliffs are 800 k up north. But we still think there are more because especially a couple of people found elephant tusks.
Right.
And that was really interesting because how did the elephant tusk came on that spot where a couple of ships were shipwrecked that were earlier and supposed not to have elephant tusk.
Right.
So there is a big dispute in that because we know that the Gild Dragon had elephant tusks.
Yeah.
And Graham Henderson, the former director of the Shipwreck Museum, found them. But yeah, there is still a lot of things to discover.
Yeah, fascinating stuff. And so, there are so many artifacts which have been raised from the wrecks here. Take me to a couple of your favourite. What's interesting here?
Well, I'm really interested in maritime. So for me, it's the ship itself.
Okay.
I like the artifacts and I like all the things that tell a story. Especially the coins are really amazing.
Wow.
Because
they are fantastic. Look at these. I'm looking at a display. Oh my goodness me! I've just realised that I'm looking at an enormous amount. I thought we were just looking at these, but
no, it's the carpet of silver, and there are
carpet of silver.
Yeah, the ships that had thousands of coins at them, and most of them had, of course, the coins made in South America. The Spanish reals are very famous. But there are an enormous amount of coins still.
Yeah, it says here of the Batavia, wrecked on Morning Reef, and it was carrying money chests containing 259,788 guilders.
Yeah.
Most of the chests were salvaged at the time, but there is still a large amount here. They're magnificent things.
So, yeah, and there is a lot of glass, silver, pipes, you know, because all the people smoked. Most of them were men. On the Batavia there were some women, but pipes were very important.
Yeah, made in Gouda.
Yeah, made in Gouda, indeed.
There's a dice, there's a wonderful collection of glass, coloured glass here, purple.
Yeah, it's the big ships had glass. The smaller yacht didn't have glass. It was not allowed to have glass on the small boat because if the crew would smash them on the deck, it could start a fire.
Right.
So they were only taken to the captain's cabin, and the small yachts didn't have a big captain's area. So they had only wood like Beardman's things, but glass was a very important thing on the bigger ships like the Batavia.
Yeah. And so there's some silver as well. Now here's a model of a fascinating ship.
Yes, it's a model of actually the first wooden boat built in WA and actually in whole Australia. It's built by Adrian de Jong. Adrian de Jong is the most important, together with Kees de Heer, model maker of this museum. He also made it for the big maritime museum, different models.
So tell me the story of the building of the ship.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
Well,
isn't it?
The story is amazing because he translated the logbook from Adriaan de Graaf, who was the captain at that time on the Zeeweg. And because of that logbook, he could translate how they built the ship, because Adriaan de Graaf wrote in his diary, in his logbook, bit by bit how they built the ship, what they needed.
So the original ship is wrecked?
Yes, it's wrecked, but it's still around on the reef.
So they've still got the timber?
Yes, now not all, but parts of it. And part of it was also that they could rescue a box with tools, other things. So sails, ropes, other...
What year is this?
This is in 1727.
Okay.
And it took them 8 months to build the ship. And first they send a longboat with the party to go to Indonesia, the same as actually the Batavia longboat did 100 yeah. years before them. And they decided...
To get help,
because they knew they were... there wouldn't be a rescue ship there coming to save them.
Yeah.
But the longboat, disappeared. And, then they knew, well, nothing will happen. We have to...
Save ourselves.
So they start building the ship and with mangrove wood from the mainland and the islands. So they put a ship together. That was really seaworthy.
Yeah.
So it was amazing. And the lucky thing, they had seals on the island, so they survived. They had rainwater. So the 80 people could survive.
Yeah.
And they made it to Batavia. So technically, it's the first ship that's built here, wooden boat, in Australia.
Yeah.
And it actually was in Batavia, still functioning for a couple of years in the harbour.
Really?
To go between the big ships and to tell this amazing story.
It is an extraordinary story. I think we should find out more about it. Let's bring everything up to date a bit now. Is there still a tradition of shipbuilding, wooden shipbuilding in Western Australia?
Oh yes, there is. There is a lot of shipbuilding. Actually, every 3 months a ship is launched,
right.
A wooden boat. We have a lot of original shipbuilders from the Endeavour, from Replica and the Divco Replica around. We have Amateur Boat Builders Association, Maritime Heritage Association, the old gaffers. They all build boats and they sail and they keep the tradition alive.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to find out a little bit more about the building of replicas later when I chat with Graham. And let's bring up the story of the Dutch in Western Australia up to the present day, because there's a big Dutch community here, isn't
there? Yes, we have about 300,000 Dutchies in Australia, and we have actually 30,000 Dutchies here in West Australia. So it's a very, very big community here. And we have a lot of organizations connected to it. We have a business club, we have a historical club, we have Nederlandia, because most of them came from either the Dutch East Indies or they came from the Netherlands after the war, because, there was no future in the Netherlands.
There were two kind of big periods of emigration, the 1920s and then the 50s, is that correct?
Yeah, well, it was indeed just before the Japanese war started in Indonesia, or the whole turbulent area. So people left Indonesia before that. It was still a Dutch colony at that time.
Yeah.
But they went first to the Netherlands, but then the war started there. So
yeah.
It was not a really amazing time, and they didn't fit in the Netherlands anymore. So they want to go back to the tropics. And the Australian government decided, okay, you're going to get a ticket to come here, because they needed a lot of people as well.
Yeah.
And a lot of them became farmers, especially in the area here in the south. But a lot of people went to Brisbane, Tasmania, and also the east coast. But we have a very large population here.
Do we know much about the vessels, the emigrant ships that took
everyone
across?
Yeah. I'm also the curator of an immigration group, Nonya Pieters. We have a professor at Curtin University. She's an amazing person. She is an immigrant. She came. Her family came from Indonesia, immigrated before the war to the Netherlands. And then they couldn't fit in anymore, and after the war they came to Australia.
Yeah.
And she writes books. She's professor of immigration at Curtin University here. And we just finished an exhibition on the Australian embassy in the Netherlands, in The Hague, and that's now coming here to travel around. She wrote a lot of books, and there is a lot of information about immigration here.
Wonderful. Well, I'll be sure to come back and find out a little bit more about it. Ellie, thank you very much indeed for giving me the talk.
No, you're welcome.
Thank you all so much for listening. Now, please don't let this be the last thing that you do to interact with our fabulous podcast. Firstly, go to YouTube and find the Mariner's Mirror podcast YouTube page. It's phenomenal. An ever-growing library of some of the most extraordinary and innovative videos showcasing our maritime past in new ways. My current favourite is the 3D animation showing how a 250-ton, 21-metre, 3,500-year-old granite obelisk was shipped from Alexandria to London in 1878. And if you're interested in maritime technology, as I know that many of you are, please look at the animation explaining how a curious 19th century propeller worked with blades that moved in opposite directions. This one has actually gone viral online, and a clip of it has been seen by 4.2 million people on Instagram. Well done, us. As always, please remember that this podcast comes from both the Society for Nautical Research and the Lloyd's Register Foundation. So do please be sure to check out both of those institutions. You can find the Society for Nautical Research at snr.org.uk. They have a vibrant international membership, so please join. It's a brilliant way of not only meeting people, but of learning about the past from the world's very best maritime historians. And the History and Education Centre of the Lloyd's Register Foundation, which has been doing maritime historical work since 1760, you can find at hec.lrfoundation.org.uk. They, in particular, have a fabulous new project called Maritime Innovation in Miniature, where they are filming the world's best ship models with the latest camera technology. It really is quite extraordinary. To find it, just Google Maritime Innovation in Miniature.
When you visit Arizona, time is measured in moments, not minutes. Like the moment you see the Grand Canyon for the first time. Visit a new state of mind. Learn more at hereyouareaz.com.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Late bloomers tend to have more curiosity. They tend to have more resilience.
There are stories and mythology that this country has woven around black men.
This is the cavalry, right? These are the leaders, the hometown heroes and local leaders. And we are.
It's a survival mechanism to just be like wary of police.
What if everything we've been taught is just all wrong?
What's worth more than this fear right now?
And that rising after failure is part of the glory of being a human being.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.